What I want us to do this morning in the Sunday School Hour is to continue looking at certain divine attributes in the past. Just looking over the last maybe 18 months when I've had occasion to be with you, we've looked at doctrines like divine incomprehensibility a few different times. We've looked at the doctrine of divine simplicity, that God is without parts. We've talked about aseity or independence, that God does not depend on anything outside himself for the very existence and being and activity that he is. And connected to that, we've also talked, this is a little further back, about divine impassibility, that God is without passions, as sort of a subset of this idea that God doesn't change. God doesn't take on new states of actuality. He's not in process from what he was to what he's becoming. That's what creatures do. But this is not what God does. What I want us to do this morning is press on a little further, if we can, into this week and next, into a consideration of a couple of more attributes that are listed in Confession chapter 2, 1. This is and the ones I want to look at are immensity or omnipresence this week, and eternity, if we can, next week. Let's look again at chapter 2. Excellent. Thank you. Appreciate that. Chapter 2. This is on page 671 at the end of your hymnal, 671, chapter 2, paragraph 1. I'll read the first paragraph, and then we'll get into a discussion of immensity or omnipresence. The Lord our God is but one only living and true God, whose subsistence is in and of himself, infinite in being and perfection, whose essence cannot be comprehended by any but himself, a most pure spirit, invisible, without body, parts, or passions, who only hath immortality, dwelling in the light which no man can approach unto, who is immutable, then our doctrines for this week and next, immense, eternal, incomprehensible, almighty, every way infinite, most holy, most wise, most free, most absolute, working all things according to the counsel of his own immutable and most righteous will for his own glory, but most loving, gracious, merciful, long-suffering, abundant in goodness and truth, forgiving iniquity, transgression, and sin, the rewarder of them that diligently seek him, and withal most just and terrible in his judgments, hating all sin, and who will by no means clear the guilty. All right, such is the first paragraph of Confession, chapter 2. With this question of omnipresence or immensity, I want to sort of probe into it, look at its biblical foundation. What would the Bible have us believe about this? And then, if we can, wrestle through some of the locational ways that the Bible speaks about God, and how is it that God's presence seems to appear in some places and be absent in others? And how do we reconcile this with divine omnipresence? And so what we'll do is we're really looking at divine omnipresence, but we're taking a sort of diversion in the middle of this to consider God's special manifestation of presence in certain places and at certain times, and to really try to situate that with respect to omnipresence and understand what we're to make of that type of information. So let me begin with a brief description, definition, and then we'll get into some biblical foundation for this. I like this statement from Augustine of Hippo. To discover where he is hard, he says. To discover where he is not is even harder. This his statement in his Confessions, amplifying this fact that God is the inescapable reality, the context of our lives, that we can say in a non-pantheistic way that God is our environment, that there's a sense in which God's presence is that condition that most ultimately matters and affects our lives. Very simply put, when we say that God is omnipresent, we mean that God is fully present to every place, yet is confined by none. And it's important that we say both, that we don't take his presence to place to be a kind of conscription or of a coordination, so to speak, of his being, so that you could plot God out on a sort of latitude, longitude, and figure out the where of God's being. There's a certain sense in which God's being is present to every place, and yet is no where in particular. OK, Okay? And we need to sort of get at both of these aspects of the doctrine. Sometimes called immensity. That's how our confession describes it. It's rooted in the conviction that God is infinite and, if I can put this word in your vocabulary, incorporeal. That's how the Puritans would have said it. But who wants to hazard a incorporeal?
Not embodied form,
right? Corporeal are things that are bodily, extended material objects. When you die and they lay this thing on a slab in the morgue, they call it your corpse, right? God is not a corporeal type being, a being extended in space. So we want to talk about an omnipresence, and when we get around to this toward the end, we'll discuss this as well, that it's an omnipresence, but it is not omnispatial. That would be a wrong way to think of omnipresence. It's not omni-extensionality. God is not an extended being in space. He is not a spatial type being in which space sort of measures him in any way. Nevertheless, he is in all places. What are we to make of this? How do we juggle these sort of twin affirmations? Maybe the first thing we should do is look at a few key texts that undergird this doctrine. I'll begin just briefly with sort of more of a macro context, looking at Deuteronomy 10:14. The context, in one sense, of understanding omnipresence is understanding that all things belong to the Lord, that there's no place that exists, that is somehow outside of His dominion, outside of His rule. Deuteronomy chapter 10, I'll start in verse 12. He says, "Now Israel, what does Yahweh your God require from you but to fear the Lord your God, to walk in all His ways and to love Him and to serve the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and to keep the Lord's commandments and His good statutes which I'm commanding you today for your good? Behold, to the Lord your God belong heaven and the highest heavens, the earth and all that is in it." If we want a sort of big context for understanding omnipresence, this would probably be the place to start, that all things are God's possession. The reason He is present to all, the way He is present to all things is as their divine possessor. The one who upholds them all, the one who possesses them all as his very creation. All right, let's get into a little bit more focused texts in this connection. And let's go to Acts 17, if you would. And we'll turn around in a few different texts here at the front end, discussing them briefly as we get into it. Acts 17, Paul, if you remember, is on Mars Hill. And he's confronting the Athenian philosophers on Mars Hill. The gods of the Athenians... immense or spatially located? Spatially located, right? In Athens, where do the gods dwell? Your hint, I'll get you located here. Your hint would be verse 23, verse 24, following after that. Yeah, starting in verse 23. Where do the gods of Athens dwell? Yeah, in the houses made with hands. They dwell in the houses that people have built for them. When they're not in the house, we're talking about a vast pantheon, of course, where do all the super gods, so to speak, of the Greek pantheon dwell? They have their own holy mountain on Mount Olympus, right? And so the gods move about in time and in space, and they have... They're temporal beings. They are spatial beings. They are not in all places at all times. And this is why the gods, as they battle with each other, are able to sometimes pull one over on their opponent god. You know how this is, if you read Homer and Hesiod and the mythology of the Greeks, and you understand this. Zeus might be sort of head honcho, but there's Poseidon, and there are the others, and they're sort of zipping around the world trying to kind of maintain and promote their agenda. But since they're not in all places at all times, and they're certainly not omniscient, sometimes they win and sometimes they lose. Right? This is just the Greek version of the Old Testament's finite territorial gods, Molech and Baal and Asherim. These are territorial gods. whose dominion extends just so far, and sometimes the dominion grows if the armies that serve them win a victory, and sometimes it shrinks if they lose a victory. And the temptation, of course, of Old Testament Israel is to think God's like this. God's our territorial God. And of course, the nations assume that Yahweh is a territorial God like theirs. And if they defeat the Israelites, the over-easy and completely false assumption is, this is Yahweh losing. Yahweh is not in that sort of pagan schematic, whether it's Old Testament or whether it's the Greek religions, is not an omnipresent God. Well, Paul confronts this whole notion of how they even understand God, and he's not saying. And sometimes we misread this. He says, "I was passing through and examining the objects of your worship, and I found an altar with this inscription to an unknown God. Therefore, what you worship in ignorance, this I proclaim." But what we don't, but then what he proceeds to do, and what we don't want to do is conclude that Paul means to say, "Hey, I've got one more for you. Throw Yahweh in the mix, and you know that'll sort of fill out your religious pantheon and make it more complete. He's the missing player or something like that." In fact, what he proceeds to do is he actually proceeds to undermine everything that they think gods are. Everything that they understand it to be a god is sort of systematically removed by Paul as he goes on and says, this is the unknown God, the one you don't know, the one of which you're ignorant, is the only one really worthy of the name. And let's start with this whole thing about where he lives. Okay? The God who made the world and all things in it, since he is Lord, in this case he's using the word Lord, Adonai, master, sovereign, would be the idea. Since he is Lord of heaven and earth, does not dwell in temples made with hands. The Lord of heaven and earth is not somehow in retreat from his earth, living in a little house built somewhere for him. Okay? He's not a God who has to sort of go out from his dwelling, get up and get out from his dwelling to go around and sort of exercise his little sovereign plan. In fact, he doesn't exist in this sort of confined, walled-in way whatsoever. This is, Paul is echoing, if you remember, the language of Solomon at the dedication of the temple, where Solomon says, at the dedication of the temple, "Will the Lord indeed dwell upon the earth? Behold, the heaven and the heaven of heavens cannot contain him. How much more this house which I have built?" And we might think to ourselves, well, the Israelites had a house for God. They first had a tent, and then they had a house. So aren't they just falling in? Isn't God just sort of allowing himself to be thought of as another one of the territorial gods who has an address? You know, he's over here. And this is his little area of where he works. And in fact, at the very dedication of his house, with all the glory and all the superabundance that made that house more remarkable than any other house for any of the other gods in all the nations, and even at that moment, there's this reminder, this deep piety in the heart of Solomon, in which he says, "Let us not delude ourselves into thinking that we have just, in a certain sense, captured a god like the nations capture in their little houses for their gods." This, whatever we're, and we'll get to this in a moment, but whatever we're to make of this dwelling of God in the temple in Jerusalem, we are not to make of it divine confinement or divine conscription. We're not getting God here trapped into our territory so that, you know, lucky us, we have a God in the neighborhood. Okay? It's not how it works. He says he doesn't dwell in temples made with hands. That's a very, as one train of the Old Testament scriptures, Paul would have never remembered not knowing that. That would have been a truth that was hammered in his earliest upbringing. Nor is he served by human hands as though he needed anything, since he himself gives to all people life, breath, and all things. I went to this text when we talked about God's independence and self-sufficiency, and it's a great text for that, but it's also a good text for omnipresence, which is to say, God is not a God confined by his creatures. He provides for the creatures, but the creatures do, he gives place to creatures, but creatures don't give place to him. And he expounds that in verse 26. "And he made from one man every nation of mankind to live on all the face of the earth." And then it says this, "having determined their appointed times," we'll talk about that when we talk about eternity next week, and then this, "and the boundaries of their habitation." So what is Paul doing? Paul is saying, in Athens, who determines the boundaries of whose habitations? The people determine the boundaries of the gods' habitations by building them houses, putting them in boxes, so to speak. Actually, literally, that's probably what they think they're doing. You can still find this way of thinking. If you go, even in modern-day India, you know, you travel along and the people are living in sort of ramshackle, rundown places, and there are these nice whitewashed concrete structures that house the various gods of their pantheon. This idea that somehow by building this house, I've got him in the neighborhood by doing this. And he says, that's wrong. In fact, it's not the world that puts a limit and confines God. It's rather God who determines our habitation. God gives us where. We don't give it to him. He provides place for us. We do not turn around and then say, oh, we'll make a place for you. And if we do make a place for him, whether that is in our heart or whether that's on a hill in Zion, we should never be deceived into thinking that we're actually getting him or confining him or containing him in that respect. That his dwelling actually exceeds, this is, and we'll get to this in a second, but his dwelling actually exceeds the manifestation of that dwelling in earthly temples. Okay, so we'll come to that in a moment. Then he goes on. So he's undermining this whole idea of the territorial gods by this description that God gives you territory, you don't give it to him, and he doesn't exist in that way. He says he did this. He gives us our times and habitations that we would seek God if perhaps they might grope for him and find him, though he's not far from each one of us. So now we get into this question of, well, if God isn't confined, if God isn't in this house over here or in that house over there, and if he's the giver of place and he's not the receiver of place, well, then where is he, you might ask? And to this question, Paul says, he is not far from each one of us. So he's near. Okay? But he's not near like three streets over, take a left, near. Okay? He's nearer than that. And the next question might come up then. Okay, he's not confined. I can't find God's address. Okay. So where is he? You say he's near to me. Well, help me a little bit. How near? How near? And then he really takes us beyond, in terms of how we can conceive of this. He says, he is not far from each one of us. Verse 28, how near is he? Here's the answer. For in him, watch this, in him we live, move, and have our being, or are, or exist. How near is God to you? God is as near to you as your very act of existing. How near is that? Like, well, let me put it this way. Can you point to anything in you that is not present to your act of existing? It's even straight. What would that even be? That would be nothing. That would be what you aren't. Everything that you are is absolutely suffused by the act of being. That is to say, everything you are is suffused with isness. Okay, and it's more than just, it's your being, but it's also your living, it's your moving, it's your activity. Everything that characterizes you, that unique feature that you have over the inanimate objects of being a living thing, that unique power you have as an automobile, right, a self-mover, all the things that might make you feel like you're sort of set apart, these do not give you space and distance from God. This thing that sets you apart from other things, I can move away from the podium because I can move myself. I live. There's a dynamism in me that isn't in this bench here or in my watch even. There are all these things that in a certain sense set me apart and allow me to sort of take place for myself. Do not in any way move me away from God in this relevant respect. How near is God to me? He is as near as my very act of existing. I don't, for a moment, do a quick sidestep and get away from his presence to me at that moment. Augustine once said, and I'm sure I'll garble the statement, but something to this effect, that God is that which is most inward in every person. Paul's talking here not just about the believer. He's not talking about the spiritual presence of God in his spirit. He's talking about God as the creator and sustainer of all things. He's talking to a bunch of pagans and saying this, and it's important that we see that that's the context in which he's doing it. This is an omnipresence, not the omnipresence of manifested covenantal favor. We'll talk about that. This is the presence of maker, sustainer, giver of all good gifts. This presence is never absent, doesn't ebb and flow. It's not a force field that is sometimes intense and sometimes weak. This is an intensive presence with the intensity of causal power in the deepest existential sense. Why do I say existential? Because that's the word Paul uses. In him we live, move, and are, have our being, exist. Okay? How near is God to his creation? He is as near as the very existence by which any creature is. In other words, he couldn't be nearer. You could say in some respects, God is nearer than you are to yourself. So he begins with this kind of, what I like to call this intensive omnipresence. This is not the, we'll get to the extensive in a second, but this is an intensive kind of omnipresence in which there's not some little holdout down there inside of you that's the place God isn't. Okay? Whatever this, we'll have to characterize the presence and characterize what we mean by nearness. And we'll have to make some denials. Like, this is not God invading your space, because God isn't a spatial kind of thing. This isn't God displacing you to the extent he's taking. God isn't sharing space with you and with me. God isn't filling all the empty and available spaces. The space is not already taken by extended objects. Okay, this is not how God exists. God is not present as a space sharer. Okay, whatever we're to say of it, we'll come to that a little later toward the end. But he is present in his power as maker to be. Okay? As the giver of all, as the giver and sustainer of all being itself. All right, let's go to an extensive omnipresence passage, Jeremiah chapter 23. This is a good proof texty passage for omnipresence. I think it's good that we start with the intensive, because I think that existential point that Paul puts on it really explains why there cannot be something that is in creation to which God is not present in the fullness of his power as its maker. This is the thing, though. We can say that, we can reason through that, but in truth, we can become forgetful of this, and this reality of God's presence can be obscured as we are deluded by our sin. And in the context of Jeremiah 23, Jeremiah is confronting false prophets in the southern kingdom of Israel during the time of the exile, false prophets who were saying, hey, it's all going to get better, everything's going to be fine, you're not going to really be taken away into exile, tickling itchy ears, telling them what they wanted to hear. And there's this confrontation that begins in verse 16. Thus says the Lord of hosts, Jeremiah 23, do not listen to the words of the prophets who are prophesying to you. They are leading you into futility. They speak a vision of their own imagination or of their own heart, not from the mouth of the Lord. They kept saying to those who despise me, the Lord said, you will have peace. Okay, just telling the people what they wanted to hear. It goes on like this for a while. He says, but they haven't heard the counsel of the Lord. They have not heard his word. He says, behold, the storm of the Lord, verse 19, has gone forth in wrath, even a whirling tempest. It will swirl down on the head of the wicked. The anger of the Lord will not turn back until he's performed and carried out the purposes of his heart. In the last days, you will clearly understand it. So his point is, it's not going to happen like these false prophets are saying. It's actually going to be the opposite. This is what it's going to look like. I am going to swirl down upon your head in a manifestation of carnage and wrath that you haven't dreamt of. And of course, then you can read Jeremiah's Lamentations if you want to see a prophet standing in the middle of that whirlwind after it's come through town. But this is the question you might ask yourself. What were these false prophets thinking? Like, what deluded them into thinking that they could just say, oh, the Yahweh told me, Yahweh said this, Yahweh. What makes us think that we can be false in this case, that we can be untrue in any respect of our heart, our behavior, our conduct, and somehow that's not going to be fully before the face of the Lord? He says, I did not send these prophets, but they ran. I did not speak to them, but they prophesied. If they'd stood in my counsel, they would have announced my words. They would have turned back the people from their evil way and from their evil deeds. And now we get to this, verse 23. And this is God, 23 and 24 is God's, in effect, what were you thinking? What were you thinking? Am I a God who is near? It's rhetorical. Am I a God who is near, declares the Lord, and not a God far off? Answer, it's rhetorical. Is God near? Yes, he is. Is he not far off? Yes, he is not far. Sorry, it's a negative, but that's how he asked it. Yes, he is not far off. So, you knew that I was near and not far off, and yet you proceeded to tell lies in my name. Now we get to this. Can a man hide himself in hiding places so I do not see him, declares the Lord? And then this, and here's, if you want sort of a nice sort of good proof text of this doctrine. Do I not fill the heavens and the earth, declares the Lord? In other words, you never slip into that place where God is not in, okay? To that place where God is out, busy doing other things, vacated for a while. The gods of the nations, you know how, I mean, I think we see this in Elijah's mockery of Baal on top of Mount Carmel, where he's up there with the prophets of Baal, and they're crying out, and he's mocking them, and he's mocking them actually because they believe in a spatial temporal God, and he's saying things like, well, maybe he's on vacation, maybe he's on a trip, and that's why he can't hear you. There are other things that maybe he's in the bathroom. That's one of the mockeries that the prophet gets. Maybe he's relieving himself. And so when he's out of the bathroom, he'll have, you know, in other words, he's capitalizing on their spatiotemporal, territorial, finite God, which isn't a God at all. And he's showing them the mockery and the abysmal, the ridiculousness at one level, the insanity of worshiping such a thing. And here there's a similar confrontation. Can a man hide himself in hiding places? This is the thing. This is a doctrine that kind of gets up. While God doesn't share space with us, God does kind of get up in our space. Right? There's a sense in which privacy, this doctrine explodes this myth of privacy. There's no firewall that you hide behind with God. There's no locked door. There's no secret inner sanctum that is just your place. Not even in your mind, by the way. That's the place you can hide from the rest of us. You know, the stuff where you don't do anything wrong, you just think wrong. Okay? The place where you can fool everybody most successfully. Even there, if we go back to the intensive omnipresence, even there, you aren't in the place God isn't. Do not I fill heaven and earth, declares the Lord. This is actually a kind of threatening and ominous omnipresence, in which this actually explodes this myth of privacy that somehow I have carried off some secret design apart from the face of the Lord. Sometimes the omnipresence doctrine is used in Scripture to terrify us, to bring us to our senses. Sometimes it's also given to console us and to give us assurance that, in fact, we are not sort of stumbling through this life, sometimes near him, sometimes far from him, insofar as he is the creator, the sustainer of all things. A good text in that regard, Psalm 139. This one you know well, I'm sure. Psalm 139, verses 7 to 10. David's talked about God's care over him and watching care in verses 1 through 4, and then he gives sort of a great statement in verse 5. You've enclosed me behind and before, you've laid your hand upon me. So David's point is, there's nowhere I'm going in this life in which I'm outside of God's hand, his watch and care over me. And then he has a number of rhetorical questions in verses 7 through 10. Where can I go from your spirit? right? He says, or where can I flee from your presence? And the answer is, he's not saying, I want to, I wish I could. He's just simply saying, what could possibly happen to me that would suddenly land me outside of the presence of my God? And I think we can take this somewhat in the poetical fashion in which it's written. I don't think he's simply talking here about space, you know, locomotive type of, you know, if I really move fast and, you know, get down the mountain or, you know, this type of thing, will he find me there? It certainly means at least that much. But I think he also means that God's presence simply fills his life so that there's also no set of circumstances, no matter how chaotic or quickly they may come upon him, in which he lands outside of the place of God's providence and governing. He says, where can I go from your spirit? Where can I flee from your presence? And then he begins us on a series of questions. And if you can think of it like this, verse 8 is the vertical question, up or down. And then verse 9 and verse 10, but mainly verse 9, gets into the horizontal question. Okay, I can't go up, I can't go down, I can't go east, I can't go west. So let's start with this briefly. If I ascend to heaven, you are there. I always like to say, you know, the least surprising. Right? If you ascend to heaven, you are there. Right, that's where most people assume they're going to be in the presence of God. And of course, there is a special manifested theophanic presence in heaven, which makes the display of his presence there more resplendent than anything we've seen. But nevertheless, if I ascend to heaven, you are there. Then he goes the opposite direction. If I make my bed in Sheol, behold, you are there. Sheol, that term can be taken in two ways. It could just simply refer to the grave, the place of the dead. It could also refer to the place of condemnation of the dead. Gets into this question that people ask sometimes, is God present in hell? Let me just make quick work of that question. Of course he is. In other words, hell isn't the place where God is not present making things be. Okay, go back to our intensive idea. Hell isn't the place where God somehow is, in terms of his being, sort of evacuated. That would be to say that something can exist without God being the immediate agent by which it exists. Obviously, in that sense, God's in hell. God's also in hell in a theophanic manifested way. He is in hell manifesting himself in terms of his holiness as a consuming fire of wrath. So that there is a presence of God in hell, not the favorable presence of his face smiling or shining upon you. It's the presence of God's face in his eyes, he says this, and I think it's in Amos, his eyes set for evil against you. Okay, there is still a kind of manifestation of his face, so to speak, but it's his face face looking furious as the display of his holiness in the form of wrath. Okay, so ontologically, no, there can't be hell without God making hell be, and also hell is a place of his manifested presence, also manifested in this case under the form of wrath in opposition to sin as judge. I don't think, though, having said that, that that's exactly the point David's making. I think David is saying, if I die, you are there. In the Old Testament, you have places like Psalm 116 that say, precious in the sight of the Lord is the death of his holy ones. Right? And what's that? His godly ones, yeah. So there are places in the Old Testament that give us consolation in the face of death, but there's not a kind of morbid welcoming of death. Even with David and the other inspired authors, there's still a hatefulness and a dislike of death. And it's not because they don't have trust. It's not because they don't know that the Lord will overcome death or promises to do this. I mean, that's, of course, exactly Abraham's belief. When he goes to sacrifice Isaac, he believes that God will raise him from the dead. It's not that they don't have a doctrine or a knowledge of resurrection power. It's the fact that they still find death to be a dreadful thing. And I check yourself if there isn't somewhere in you where you just don't like the idea of death or of losing loved ones to death. I don't like the idea of death, not because I don't trust the Lord, but because death is Because death is the illegitimate offspring of lust conceiving, bringing forth sin, and therefore producing the illegitimate offspring of death. There is a hatefulness and a repulsiveness to death as condemnation that we should loathe and hate. And that's what the psalmist, I think, is talking about here. That thing, what does death do? Death, part of the dread of death is that death, more than any other experience you have in life, cuts you off from everything familiar. It takes you, look, a plane could take you away, and Pastor Dunn's in a different continent right now, and you could be taken away into different places in this world, but you're still in the land of the living, and nowadays you can just hop online and zip an email or do some FaceTime or whatever. You can sort of overcome the distance. But death is that trip, that voyage, as it were, that going away that is unlike any other removal. That it takes us away from that which we love. And there's a dread of this. And here's the point of the psalmist. And I think we need to grab hold of this for omnipresence. Death is a great separator, but not that great. What death doesn't separate you from is the consolation of God's presence. You don't, in death, end up somewhere far away from Him. You end up far away from much else. But you don't end up far away from Him. And in fact, the consolation that God is present to us in Sheol, in the place of death, for the psalmist is his hope here. That while he doesn't relish the idea of being taken away by death, his great consolation is it doesn't take him away from that which matters most to him, which is the presence of God. If I ascend to heaven, you are there. If I make my bed in the grave, maybe nothing else is familiar to me there, but you are there. Okay. Then he goes, I like to think that the vertical, the up and the down. Then he moves the imagery to a horizontal plane. He says, if I take the wings of the dawn, if I dwell in the remotest part of the sea, even there your hand will lead me, your right hand will lay hold of me. This language gets highly poetic. And commentators sort of wrangle over what to make of this language of taking the wings of the dawn. Probably this is the best I've heard in terms of explanation, and it seems like it fits the context as well. Probably he's referring to the sunlight. He's referring to the beams of light, the wings of the dawn, as the beams of light that are shooting east to west across the sky. And shooting from the east, in his case, over the sea, which is, of course, the Mediterranean Sea, and off to the edge of the known world. Okay, right? What's now Portugal would have been sort of the edge of the known world to them. He says, if I take the wings of the dawn, if I dwell in the remotest part of the sea, even there your hand will lead me and your right hand will lay hold of me. I think he's getting at this. It's something like this. If I grabbed hold of light as it sped through the sky and I got dropped on the remotest part of the sea, I think here he may mean the remotest part of the sea, meaning the other side of the sea around which all the civilized world of that time lives. Okay. If I end up, it could be something like this. If I end up in a split second on the other side of the world, in a complete no man's land, as it were, with nothing familiar around me, with all of my circumstances turned on their head in a moment, I think that's what he's saying. I didn't just land in the place God isn't. I didn't just somehow zip out of his presence and he's going to, you know, find me in a day or two. Okay? That's, he says, even there, this is beautiful, even there your hand will lead me. I like that he says that. He doesn't say, even there, you're so fast you can catch up to me. That leaves you with a split second or more in which you don't have the benefit and the consolation of omnipresence because there's no omnipresence. And in fact, the psalmist is saying, that's not the case. My world, and sometimes this happens, my world may change in an instant. It may change in a moment, and nothing seems familiar. Friends, David's case, things like this happen. Friends become enemies. He knows a lot of traitorous people that were once his very dear friends and comrades, brothers in arms. They turn on him. They choose Absalom in some cases. A child, in his case, kills another of his children. This is the kind of stuff that most of us don't feel like we have somebody that's going to really understand that. Right? When that happens in our lives, people can feel for you and will pray for you, but there's a certain aloneness in that. David knew aloneness. He had faithful comrades with him, but there was still a loneliness and a pain that he bore uniquely. Life can be like that. Bearing our cross and walking the way of the Savior sometimes can feel unique and alone in the type of pain it inflicts on us. I think he may have something like this in mind. I said, if we read this poetically, I think he's talking about this. If my circumstances turn in an instant completely on their head, and I'm on the other side of the world, I'm on the remotest part of the sea, where I don't, it's not my land, it's not my place, it's not my people, it's not my resources, I'm just on the other side of the world suddenly. God's directing, leading me. It goes back to verse 5. You've enclosed me behind me before your hand is laid upon me. So, the omnipresence of God for the unbeliever, right? A terrifying thought. Even for the believer, when we imagine that somehow our sin is going unnoticed, as if it's not coram Deo, right? As if it's not before the face of God, it should challenge us. By the same token, it should also be for us the great consolation. The omnipresence, the immensity of God is a horrifying thought to the wicked. And the immensity of God is the height of consolation to his people. We should find encouragement and consolation in his omnipresence. I mentioned earlier the statement in 1 Kings, the heaven of heavens cannot contain God. I think this is the point, that though God fills heaven and earth, God is not in a certain sense hemmed in by it. And though he is present with us in heaven or in Sheol, in our present circumstances, or if our circumstances change and drop us on the other side of the world, though he's present in all these ways, we should not think that somehow God is present in the way we are, but just a little more extended. Okay, you're present here, but he's got, you know, some more locations covered. We shouldn't think of it like that. Because in the words of Solomon, when he says, the heaven of heavens cannot contain you, whatever the omnipresence of God means with regard to his presence in his creation, it is not like your presence just spread out and bigger. Okay, and that's what, so when we say omnipresence, we don't want to think human presence, you know, to the whatever degree. We want to think of a different sort of presence, a presence of the one who makes all to be, a presence of the one who sustains all things. All right, we have a few minutes. Let me at least, and I can pick this up next week. Thankfully, we have two, so I can just hit the ground running with it. Differing manifestations of God's presence. This is a question that we have to sort of wrestle with, because when Scripture talks about his presence, you'll find texts like, where can I go from your presence? Where can I flee from your spirit? But, you know, do not I fill heaven and earth? God is not far from each one of us. In him we live, move, and have our being. All these intensive and extensive, threatening and consoling statements about God's immensity. And yet there is also another kind of presence language that we find in the Bible that talks about God as here and not there. Okay? And we might feel like, well, maybe then omnipresence means that God is sort of hyper-efficient in getting around. Okay? In fact, there's even language in the Bible that talks about God in the language of getting around and of coming and going. He comes and walks in the garden in the cool of the day, and there's a presence with Adam and Eve at some time, at some place, and in some moment that it seems to be unique and different from other places and times and moments. He says in Genesis 11, with regard to those wicked men on the plain of Shinar, if you remember, that are building that tower to reach to the heavens in order to make a great name for themselves. He says there, it says in Genesis 11:5, the Lord came down to see the city and the tower which the sons of men had built. Right. He came down. Is this because the view down here of Shinar is better than the view from up there? let us go down to see. Does God have obscured vision? Is heaven somehow, is his heavenly presence just a little too remote? So he's got, what does he do? Does he, I like to say, out of office, be back at 3, taking care of those rebels in Shinar. Is his coming down a leaving behind? Okay. Some of this language I think we can appreciate just as an accommodated way of speaking. Verse 7 actually says the same thing. Come, let us go down and there confuse their language. Because confusing their language is easier down here than it is from up there. I'm saying that because I think we all know that that's not what to do with this language. But here you have locomotive activity moving about from here to there ascribed to God. I think in this case we can just simply say that Moses in writing this is actually just grabbing the language, and God is inspiring the picture of like an ancient Near Eastern monarch who, when word comes that somebody is fortifying a rebel city on the outskirts of his dominion, what's he going to do? He's going to come down. He's going to get off his throne. He's going to say, saddle the royal steed. Get my guys. We're going. We're going to check this out. We're going to investigate this report. And if this report is in fact what it is, we're going to take care of it. And he depicts God that way. He depicts God as a monarch who is jealous for the uprightness of his kingdom and for the faithfulness of those in it. And here you have some rebels making a name for themselves, building a city that has their name, not his name, fortifying their battalion for resistance. And so he uses the language of an ancient Near Eastern monarch to describe it. Again, it's not that God left heaven in order to come down and then, moves about like a locomotive entity. Genesis 18:21. God says, with regard to Sodom and Gomorrah, I will go down now and see if they have done entirely according to this outcry. Again, this doesn't mean that God doesn't actually know perfectly. He's omniscient. So he says, I'm going to go down to see, as if he's a little unclear as to the facts until he gets up and goes about, in space and finds out. He says, which has come to me, if not, I will know. He's using an accommodated language. He's using a language that technically is improper, but you get the point. He is like a monarch who is jealous for the integrity of his dominion. And he will act accordingly. Okay? He will deal with us accordingly. Exodus 3:8, we actually find the presence of God in a unique way here. He uses the same coming down language again. If you remember, he's meeting with at the burning but not consuming burning bush. He's meeting with Moses, and he's talking about the mission that he's sending Moses on in order to go and deliver the people from Egypt. And if you just listen to the description before that, it says in verse 23 of chapter 2, in the course of many days, the king of Egypt died. The sons of Israel sighed because of the bondage, and they cried out. And their cry for help because of their bondage rose up to God. Right? And you get this picture of God as up there. Not here in some way, but in some way up there. Okay? And then it says God heard the groaning, and God remembered his covenant and saw the sons of Israel, and God took notice of them. And then in verse 8, the next chapter, he says in verse 7, I've surely seen the affliction of my people, and I've given heed to their cry. I'm aware of their suffering. Verse 8, so I have come down. The prayer rose up, and God came down to deliver them from the power of the Egyptians, to bring them up from the land to a good and spacious land, and goes on to tell them it's about the Exodus. What do we do with this? If God fills heaven and earth, if he fills heaven and earth, then what can this going up and down be about, right? What can this descending of God be about? What can this going here and going there to do this and to do that be about if God in fact fills heaven and earth? If in fact he is present to all places without lack of intensity or dynamism, so to speak. I submit that much of this language is simply describing God's activity in an anthropomorphic fashion. describing it like you would describe the activity of any monarch. All the while, like Solomon, and you might think to yourself, well, isn't this going to confuse us? No, it shouldn't. The use of creaturely type language to describe God should not confuse us into thinking he's a creaturely type being. Solomon wasn't confused. Solomon built an unparalleled house for God, and yet knew, and even said in the very dedication of that house, he's not contained in it. In other words, there's a sense in which in our theologizing and in our worship of God, though we use an anthropomorphic type language, like locomotive movement, for instance, we should, like Solomon, have a kind of biblical wisdom that says, I understand that while I speak this way, or like while I build this house, or while I do and speak that which might imply that God is like a finite creature, of course it doesn't mean that at all. Right? Does that make sense? But what is does that render it unmeaning? No. It just means that the meaning is that he is not confined by the special manifestations of himself. And I think that's what we have here, and I'll open it up with that next week. But when we talk about these various presences, here and not there, turning his face away from us, or turning his face again to people, this sort of idea, we're not talking about God. At that point, we're not really talking about God's omnipresence or lack thereof. We're talking about varying intensity and phenomena of manifestation. That is to say, theophany, theophanic display, whether that's through mighty actions like in the Exodus, or whether that's through fire in a bush, or whether that's through a still small voice, or whether that's through a cloud, or whether that's through a pillar of fire, or whether that's through the form of a man sitting outside of your tent eating a meal with you, like in Genesis 18, that God uses liberally a vast range of creaturely present, physically present phenomena to manifest and show his covenantal favor. What does that look like to us? It looks like presence. It looks like locational presence. So this is what I want to do. I want to say, when we pick that up, the locational presence of God is with regard to manifestation or theophanic displays through phenomenal symbols. Fire, wind, clouds, still small voices, fire in bushes, things like this. Whereas this is not meant to compete with or undermine his ontological omnipresence with regard to his being as the one who fills heaven and earth and who causes all things that are to live, move, and have their being. All right, we'll pick that up. Let me close this in prayer and we'll go to our break.